I remember meeting Father Lou at my first board meeting, and it was really an amazing spiritual experience. And that's when I knew this was going to be a journey of faith and hope and joy, and not of sadness or depression or vindictiveness or anything like that. And it just, I'm just so delighted to have had the chance to meet him. My name is Rita Houlihan, and I'm a board member from the East Coast. And Future Church is basically one of the loves of my life. So I'm very happy to be here. And I am the last person before Sister Teresa. So I'll be brief. And if you can't hear me, raise your hands because I can't. Can you hear me? You can't hear me. Thank you. Because I tend to drop my voice. So my name is Rita Houlihan. I don't know if you heard that. And I loved Father Louis. And I'm the last person between you and Sister Teresa. Our speaker today is known to many, or this evening, is known to many of you here, and so does not need an extensive introduction. But just in case you know of only a few aspects of her remarkable life and only a few of her amazing achievements, I am delighted to fill you in on some of the highlights of her 55 years of service as a Sister of St. Mercy. A Sister of Mercy. Can you hear me now? Yes. Okay, thank you. Sister Teresa Kane is an influential voice among Catholics of the United States and has earned a prominent place in the history of U.S. women religious. When, and as Bill Wisniewski mentioned earlier, when, as president of the Leadership Conference of Women Religious in 1979, she greeted Pope John Paul II at the National Shrine in Washington, D.C., and asked for his attention on a really important matter. And I will give you the quote here, though you probably all know it, but I love these words, so I'm going to say them. As women, we have heard the powerful message of our church addressing the dignity and reverence of all persons. As women, we have pondered these words. Our contemplation leads us to state that the church, in its struggle to be faithful to its call for reverence and dignity for all persons, must respond by providing the possibility of women as persons being included in all ministries of the church. Yes. I mean, I never thought I would grow up and hear those words ever uttered, let alone by a nun. Sister Teresa has won several diverse leadership hats. Sorry, has worn several and won them too. Several diverse leadership hats over the years. With her degrees in economics, public health administration, and women's studies, she has served as the CEO and board member of St. Francis's Hospital, as the provincial of the Sisters of Mercy, as the president of the Leadership Conference of Women Religious, as delegate to the UN Conference on Women in China, and as a director and campus minister of a girls' Catholic school. And those are just a few of the things. She led and participated in assemblies resulting in a unified group of Mercy Sisters in the U.S. and Latin America. As a result of all of these accomplishments and many other parts of her life, she has received many awards. Here are just four. One of her first rewards was the President's Medal from Mercy College in Dobbs Ferry, a place close to my home. The U.S. Catholic Award for Furthering the Cause of Women in the Church, back in 1980. The Siena Medal from the Adrian Dominican Sisters in Michigan. And the Leadership Award from the Leadership Conference of Women Religious in 2004. In the midst of all this work, she did take a sabbatical in 1985, during which she was, one, a visiting scholar at Loyola College in Chicago, two, worked in a hospital in Guyana, South America, and finally, and this is the relaxing part, spent time with a group of Carmelite sisters in a monastery in upstate New York. Today, Sister Teresa is a full-time associate professor at Mercy College in Dobbs Ferry, New York. Tonight, here in this wonderful and inspiring Museum of Natural History, she will reflect with us on our beloved Catholic Church today, exploring the question of what's next, evolution or revolution? Sister Teresa Kane.
Good evening, and thank you. And I was reminded as I came tonight about the scripture story where you're having a wonderful, happy occasion, and you go out and bring the people in from the highways and the byways. Because I've been traveling from New York via Chicago and arriving here in Cleveland tonight at 7:30, and I said I came in and everybody looked so beautiful, and I said, I feel like I've just been out in the highways and byways for the day. So it's wonderful to be here. And as I listened to that beautiful testimony to Father Louis, I said, I want to dedicate my talk tonight to him. And also to encourage us when we hear the scriptures of Amos and Job and Isaiah and prophets of old, we had one in our midst. He was a prophet of the 20th century. And usually prophets are not honored until long after they're gone. So joining here tonight and remembering all that he did, and knowing, I believe so strongly, that his spirit hovers over all of our activities, all the mysteries that are in our life. So he will always be present to us. So I'm so honored to be here at his testimony. I want to say what a joyous occasion this is and to congratulate all who have brought the 20th anniversary of Future Church to being. I am grateful for the invitation, and I was honored when Chris asked me to be with you this evening. Future Church and Chris Schenck and Father Louis have always been so intricately connected to my understanding of Future Church. They somehow were the two catalysts after certainly receiving a great deal of support and consensus from not only one parish council but from many to bring this wonderful vision to a reality. So I want to say congratulations. And it's my conviction that Future Church is a movement. It's very creative, and it's also highly influential. And many people have heard of it over the years. I saw a movie a few years ago, and some of you may be familiar with it. If you haven't seen it, I urge you to see it. Pay Ahead, it's called. Has far-reaching effects about what a young boy did. And it seems to me that that's what Future Church is. It's to pay ahead. The title and the theme, Future Church, it's visionary, very forward-looking. It's paying ahead. It's moving into the future. For me, Future Church is a vision of something that is yet to come. And yet, it's already here. And it's very inspiring. So I know from personal experience that Future Church has been very influential locally, nationally, and internationally. And how moved I was to see Chris and the many other participants who moved right into the Vatican culture and corridors and the very fabric of their spirit. And it was very inspiring to know that Future Church had such an important role. When the Synod on the Word came, Chris and Future Church had so much to do with that and the changes that are continuing to be made. So it's personified by a few people, but a few people with many colleagues who have a vision. And I couldn't help but think about other moments that we've had and other movements. And just one example, and there are many, but we know when we think about the civil rights movement, Rosa Parks and Martin Luther King, they personified it for so many of us. They institutionalized it. They brought it to another level. So Father Louis and Sister Chris have done that for Future Church, along with all of you who have created it and who have renewed it and who have seen it develop for all of these years. So with that, I would like to offer some reflections on what I was asked to do tonight. Wonderful topic, very challenging. The Catholic Church today, is it an evolution or a revolution? I had much ponderings on this. So let me just offer you my approach to it. I'd like to just begin with a few reflections on both evolution and revolution, and then speak to our own 21st century moment, which I believe is exciting, creative, and a very mysterious revolution. There's no doubt that we are in the midst of a creative, exciting revolution. And then I would like to identify what I believe are some significant breakthroughs into this revolution. I identified three. That the primary identity of our church is community. That's extremely important to remember. That's a breakthrough of the 20th century. And it's our vision. And we're not going to let that vision go. That's revolutionary. So the primary identity of our church is community. The second breakthrough is a growing reverence for relationships, along with the global perspective. It's affecting the whole world. A reverence for relationships. And finally, the third breakthrough that I identified is an emerging transformation of gender equality. A transformation that is going on. All of those breakthroughs are revolutionary. Let me just say a few reflections on evolution and revolution. It seems to me that as we look back in history, we have experienced both, and sometimes simultaneously. The focus of the church's priorities through the centuries, a very significant ministry that became the focus of the Catholic Church as an institution, widows and orphans. You can go back into the ancient history prior to Christianity, throughout the scriptures, widows and orphans, women and children. A very, very important component, because why do we have widows and orphans? Because we have a military mindset, and because we have wars, and the wars are to protect the women and children. But after every war, we have widows and orphans. So the church began to address that. And many, many women, as well as men, addressed it. But I think what we did is we had the direct service to the women and children. And it's only in recent times that we would say it's not sufficient to just do the service. We need to have advocacy. So the evolution of direct service was present, but the advocacy became somewhat revolutionary. We've even moved beyond that and say, why do we have widows and orphans? So we're looking at the systemic change that needs to be looked at, much more challenging. Those are revolutionary components of that service that has been done. In the early days of the church, very revolutionary, all those early apostles and the early Christians made a commitment to share everything in common. It was a very radical direction that they took, and they attracted many followers because of it. But we also had some other developments in the church. One of them I would mention that had some evolution and yet was also very revolutionary was the development of clericalism. In the early church, the whole concept of priest was not even present. We had deacons, we had presbyters, we had those who ministered into all of the house churches. We didn't actually have the term priest. Came later on with the development of the church as an institution, 5th and 6th centuries. Then by the 10th century, it was institutionalized. It became elevated to a superhuman, almost a divine concept, the cleric. The cleric became somewhat of a godly figure to us. So those were all parts of both evolution and revolution. One other element that I would mention in revolution, the early Christians, by their new religion, were prohibited from military service. They were not allowed to be in military service. The alliance with the military way of life evolved through the centuries, so that by 1940s, at the time of World War II, there were a significant number of United States Catholics who made up the military. Major shift from what was the beginning of our religion. But I just wanted to offer that in terms of both evolution and revolution. Let me speak for a moment on our 21st century moment that I believe is exciting, creative, mysterious, and certainly a revolution. To begin with, we have just begun a new millennium. We're not beginning the next 100 years. We're beginning the next 1,000 years. And sometimes I reflect on the fact that I have spent many, many years writing 1960, 1980, 1990. That's gone forever. For the next 1,000 years, we will write 20, 21, 22. The 1,000s have finished. So that in itself puts us at a very, very new moment and a new place. It's the beginning of the next 1,000 years. We are responsible to shape those next 1,000 years because we're the creators of it. We're the first ones to live in this next 1,000 years. So we have a sacred responsibility to shape and direct it. There's no one out there who's in charge. No one has more authority than you and I in this room tonight. There's no overseeing charge person except our God. And our God is asking us to do this, to shape and direct it. So I think the 21st century and the fact that we are at the beginning of it is our sacred moment. We are all responsible to author it, direct it, and influence our moment in time. When we leave this planet and we go to our eternity, we want to have impacted it. We want to have made a difference. We want it to be a better way of life for people. And that is our sacred responsibility. So I find it exciting and creative. And there's a great deal of newness. Let me just say one item that reminds me of newness. The new nations in our world. In 1945, the beginning of the United Nations, we had 50 nations. Now, 60 years later, We have almost 200 nations, a tremendous revolution of nations that has come about. And that's part of our creativity. The civil rights movement, we know, became a worldwide movement and continues to go on, very significant in the 20th century. In 1850, to our knowledge, we had the first recording of 1 billion people living on this planet. In 2000, we had 7 billion people. We've gone from 1 billion to 7 billion. And the predictions are by the year 20 or 25, we will have as many as 10 billion people. We have the resources for our people, but we don't have the passion and the will to direct those resources. The communications explosion that we've had. We know all that has gone on since the time of radio, television, the internet, the computer, the emails, the Blackberries, the iPods, the texting, the Facebook. I mean, there was so much in terms of communications explosion and transportation explosion. All part of our revolution of the 21st century. It's my own hope and vision and passion that we, at the beginning of this 21st century, would convert the militarization of the planet that's going on to a commitment to human and social services. There are a number of studies that document if we're able to convert to the human and social services. Economically, it is advantageous, but to think of what it does to the quality of life for not millions, but billions of people in our world, billions of people. So for me, our moment is very mysterious, and I think there's a deep longing for the holy. There's a deep longing for value. We have a thirst for an enduring inner peace, and we have a growing appreciation for the spirituality of our lives. So all of that to me is part of the revolution of the 21st century that is our moment in time. It's our gift, but it's also our responsibility. Let me speak then to what I believe are significant breakthroughs that I see in this revolutionary moment. The primary identity of church is community. Secondly, a growing reverence for relationships within a global perspective. And third, an emerging transformation of gender equality. Primary identity. We need to return and to revisit to the spirit and culture of Jesus' community. They were a group of peasants, a group of ordinary people, in somewhat economically poor conditions, not all of them, but many, attracted to Jesus by his zeal, his passion, and also by his influence. He was influential with the common ordinary person, but he was also feared by the formal authorities of his day. That's a form of influence also. But there was a fear. They were concerned that he was coming at this great Messiah and he was going to usurp their power. So there was a fear of him. Community was for the early apostles and for that Jesus movement, that community was an enduring quality. We know the beautiful phrase that said, "We know they are Christians by their love. See these Christians, how they love one another." That's what they were about. So what was so present during the life of Jesus and during the early times was friendship, equality, shared governance. Remember he said, "I'm not your master. I am the one who's serving you. You're not to call anyone father, but the one who is in heaven." He had many ways of saying to them, "I will not be your master, I will be your friend." So the beginnings of our religion were community, and community was essential. So through the structures, through the systems, through the ages that we have come through, we know what has happened. We built a great institution, but we also brought about a tremendous amount of institutionalization. So Vatican Council II for us was a wake-up call. And remember, Vatican Council II came about to bring about a whole sense of community in our church, to bring about ecumenism, to bring about a sense of conscience, the importance of the individual conscience, many other factors. But keep in mind that we have come out of a 500-year period in which we had the Protestant Reformation. 500 years of it. What had happened to the Catholic Church in those 500 years? A defensive mindset, very defensive. Defend the faith. A great concern for loss of faith. A deep dividing hostility towards Protestantism. When I grew up, even the word was anathema. You would never go to a Protestant church. You just had no connection because we were defending our faith. And so Vatican Council II brought us to a whole new moment to say we needed to move away from this defense. And as a Catholic church, institutionally, we had become very imperialistic. There was no salvation outside of the Catholic Church. We had the mite boxes for our pagan babies. They were all to become Christians. Even now, so much of our language and our liturgy and our prayers is bringing everybody to Christ so the whole world gets to know Christ. 25%, 20 to 25% of the world are Christian. Other 75% are deeply spiritual people belonging to different faith traditions. We are not to be imperialistic towards other religions. But all of that was part of our mindset because we became institutionalized. So our growing belief now, as a result of 30 or 40 years from Vatican Council II, is that the structures, the systems, the institutions, and the authority figures are there to serve, advance, and foster community, because community is primary. And without community, we do not have the presence of the Holy One. We do not have the sense of the spiritual. We have a tremendous amount of legalism that goes on. And that needs to be changed. So the institutions and the structures need to be only there to serve the community. Otherwise, they're basically obstacles to us. Historically, the church and its governance adopted a monarchy, very contrary to and a great obstacle to the growth of community. So when we think about forming communities within an institution that is a monarchy, it's almost saying, this is really not going to work. How does it go together? You know, that's why we need to look at the structures and the systems. Say, how do we bring about a more collegial governance in our church? It's very important. It's a mandate we have. We know that. How do we bring about a greater sense of community with our priests, with our bishops, with our pope, so that we're there as friends? We're not fearing each other. We're not anybody's servants. We're not just following the king and in a military way, where we just follow behind. So I find, in terms of community, there are many more faith-based communities among many active Catholic laity because they're not able to find community in the traditional parish churches. I think we need to recognize it. I think we need to bless it. I think we need to say, this is how we form our community at this point in the 21st century. At the same time, how do we critique the structures and systems, and how do we arrange these or transform them so they bring about community? So that, I think, is the first breakthrough that we've had, which brings us then to say, indeed, our revolution is indeed a our changes in our church right now is indeed revolutionary. These are new experiences, new moments we've had maybe for the last 40 years, but measuring that against the 400 years when it didn't happen, we're at the very beginnings of it. My second breakthrough that I identified is a growing reverence for relationships along with a global perspective. The 18th century, we heard for the first time the rights of man. We heard about the essence of the man, the creature. And the term man was actually sexist. And it continues so because women were not considered. They truly were not included. Read any of those documents. Women were not part of our consciousness at that time. But that was a major breakthrough because up until then, countries and civilizations and through the centuries, we developed a belief that the authority was supreme, even divine. So all, with few exceptions, lived in servitude and slavery. Most of the world lived in servitude and slavery unless you were born into an economically advanced situation, which were very few. Humans were expendable. They didn't have any inner value. They were there essentially to service and be subject to the king. Right? The king was a god. And it was believed the divine right of kings, indeed, that came directly from God to the king. We have that same mindset in our own Catholic Church. The vicar of Christ, the Pope, is Jesus living among us. And he is also a king. He's a monarch. And therefore, we do not question and we do not appeal. And that he is the voice of Christ on earth. So the term supreme pontiff, that's a Roman term. That's the term that was used for the head of the Roman state, not a religious term. And at the present time in the Catholic Church, the Pope's decision is final and there's no appeal. Now, what does that say about a growing reverence for relationships in a community? It's totally opposite. And if anything, it's just dispiriting to us. And remember that we began in a community where they believed in the discipleship of equals. That was profoundly radical. And that's still our vision today. That's still the vision of future church. The scriptures say to us over and over again, we are made in the image and likeness of God. Wisdom says we're made in the very nature of God. So I'm godlike, you're godlike. We are God present on this earth. All of us have the capability to be the presence, the spirited presence, the divine presence. We're angels to one another. And many of us know we've met many angels through our years. The goodness that we can experience because we've been made in the image and likeness of God. But we built in so much negativity and also not a confidence even in our own spirituality. So I think we need to be looking at our relationships, to be dedicated and passionate about a community of mutually co-responsible adults who shape, direct, and influence our church. Passivity is not a value. Engagement, participation, and decision-making develops conscience and conscientious members. Each of us has a conscience that is very sacred, and each of us is a conscientious member of our Catholic community. So therefore, I have a responsibility to shape and direct and to influence. So if I find I'm in situations where we're still looking at the structures and the systems, and we're told we cannot do this, no, this is not allowed, no, you may not give a homily here today, no, you may not put that into the intercessions, that's not developing community. So we need to make conscientious decisions about that. And that's very important for all of us because we are responsible to develop this community and to develop the relationships. And not only relationships one and with the other, but among all of the members of our planet community. It has a global perspective. We're all struggling for a sense of reverence in our relationships. And I believe that's an emerging breakthrough. The third and final one I identify is an emerging transformation of gender equality. When I first wrote this, I said, it's an urgent, critical issue. And I went back and changed it. I said, no, it's not urgent, it's not critical. It certainly is that in part. But what we are experiencing about gender equality is a transformation. It's a way that we are behaving and being with one another that we have not experienced before. Now, we've begun to do it, and I think certainly the 20th century was the beginnings of us for it. But we're just, again, at the beginning moment of it. Margaret Mead, a sociologist, certainly known throughout the world, she claimed that the emergence of women as women, and that's very important to keep in mind, was a paradigm shift in the 20th century, attributed to the vote of the women, but not only that, other developments, where a woman could initiate a divorce, a woman could have a bank account, a woman could have the name, the house that she and her husband had in her own name as well as his name. Those were very dramatic changes that took place. She believed that the emergence of women as women was a paradigm shift, and she contrasted it to the Industrial Revolution and to the Ice Age. She found it that significant and that mind-altering, and I think that's actually what it is a whole new paradigm shift and a new way of being together. Gerda Lerner, who influenced a great deal of women's history from about 1950 on, she's living now back in New York, she had been in Minnesota for many years. She did, I think, in one of her writings, she said, I prefer to use the term male-defined in contrast to male-dominated. She said, male-dominated seems as if you're making a judgment. And also, we have to remember, there are certain arenas and circles where men have dominated. But there are certain circles and arenas where women have dominated. But what we have in society as a whole is basically a patriarchal understanding of life. And she said she would use it as a male-defined society. Gender inequality is not only personal, it's not corporate. It's a system that has been with us in the West. It's supposed to be 5,000 years. Margaret Mead said it's probably about 20,000 years in the East. Much of it they attribute back to when we had the breakup of the agricultural revolution, where the men had to move away from the farms. Prior to that, there was much more equality. Woman and the man and the children divided up their work among each other. But they were basically there as a unit and as a community. So the gender equality came about through those developments. It's a social, gender inequality is what I meant, a social, political, religious, and economic system. Each and all of those components have contributed to, they have deepened, and in the past, almost considered inequality to be of divine origins. The beginning of the 20th century, the bishops of the United States wrote a document in preparation for the women's right to vote. They were highly against it because they believed that it would take the woman out of the family unit and it would be harmful to the family. They also wrote in that document that inequality is a way of life, and it's built into the human spirit. It's actually divinely ordained, inequality. And in the late 19th century, the bishops writing about the black community said, we question whether the black man, and they said man, has a soul. So inequality was supposedly built in and was of divine origin. And as we know, prejudice of all kinds and all types springs from ignorance. But worse even than ignorance is the arrogance that goes with it, that we are so totally committed and judge that this is the only way. So we have socialized gender equalities in this way. The male is considered strong, rational, higher intelligence, the warrior, and superior. The female is fragile, inferior, emotional, limited intelligence, passive, receptive. Those are the images that we had traditionally of the male and the female. And we still have them in many, many cultures and in many places. And after many civilizations, societies are beginning to acknowledge women as women apart from being wives and mothers. A very important piece of information. If you go back through the history of the Catholic Church, we had the Virgin, very, very central to our teachings, a virgin, because we were obviously not going to be involving sex, right? Even though it's a gift from God that is built into our spirit. We had the Virgin, we had the mother, we had the widow. We didn't have the woman. One of the scholars have gone back and said, the term woman began to be used more after the Protestant Reformation, when the men were able to marry, and the men and women seemed to develop more equality, the term woman. Prior to that, you were a mother, you were a virgin, you were a nun in the Catholic Church, but not as a woman. So we had always had terms of ladies and sisters and girls. Now we've used guys for many years, which is even worse, because I don't think we go calling a group of men a couple of gals, you see, but we can do it very easily to the women. But motherhood was valued to the male in the male society because they benefited from the offspring, particularly the male offspring. You know, in the Old Testament, in the New Testament, the women prayed, not for a child, for a male child. The male child was essential to the society because the male child was the one who could do the work and take care of the farm. Didn't cost you when it was about to be married with a dowry. So the girl became more of a burden to you, except that you taught her to do all of the domestic things that needed to be done by the girl. So I think that whole sense of woman as a woman has come in, again, more recently in the last 100 years or so. I think an appreciation for the female as a woman connotes gender equality. Both female and male are challenged by it because our roles are changing. They have been for some time, as we know. So we're uncomfortable, and sometimes we'll say, oh, I'd rather go back to what I had. But in fact, what I find interesting, right now we have a phenomenon of some women politicians who are basically conservative, and they're emerging out into the public. They're called soccer moms. You notice they're not women? Called soccer moms. The last one, if you have Newsweek, showed four women. They're calling themselves grizzly bears who are taking care of their cubs. In fact, one stated just recently that she supported the Southern Baptist Convention resolution that women are to graciously submit to their husbands. Now, if we really believe in gender equality and mutuality and collaboration and the gifts of all, we don't submit to either one. Right? We reverence each other. We certainly in community have dialogue. We may have very different approaches, but the female does not always the one who's responsible to submit. But that was just said very recently. I think another area we need to look at in terms of gender equality is how we look at God. God has been traditionally a father, a king, a judge, all male terms. This week we had the Feast of the Angels, and I was reading in church in the morning, and I announced that it was the Feast of St. Michael and Gabriel and Raphael. And I said, unfortunately, I didn't have time, but I'm sure there were women angels. Where are the women angels? It's all the angels are men. That's an interesting thing, isn't it? Yeah. But so the whole image of God is a very important thing. I've always appreciated something I heard many years ago, and I continue to use it. Pope John Paul I, in 1978, said in a public statement, we need to call God Mother as well as Father. I thought it was a powerful, beautiful statement. I never say the Our Father, the glory be to the Father, glory to God, without saying Mother as well as Father. Now, those who are around me in church get really nervous. What are you saying and what are you doing? I said, I will not call God Father without also calling God Mother. But that's only, thank you. That's only one of many, many images. God is a companion. God doesn't always have to be my parent. I had parents. I'm old enough to be a grandparent. God can be my companion, my advocate, my spirit, my presence. I mean, God is always, always present. The beautiful thing about that is there are many times when I'm doing all kinds of work and I don't think about God, but God is always thinking about me. So I'm always in God's presence, even if I don't know it. So God right here is standing with me or within my spirit. So that God is a creative, inspiring power beyond any human image. And I always think about we're made in the image and likeness of God, but what we've done basically is made God in our image. And that God has been a white male king or judge or warrior. And I grew up thinking of God as an old man with a beard. That's why we all concentrated on Jesus. We didn't have to think about God. You know, Jesus became our God. So I think the whole area of gender equality needs to be looked at in terms of our spiritual life. And one of the things that we talk about through the years, and it's very important, that we all have our idols, all right? We talk about the Old Testament, Ten Commandments. What was the first one? You shall not have strange gods before me. It's my belief that if we truly believe in the equality, the discipleship of equals, and truly believe that all of us form community, and unless we truly recognize these gifts, we are being idolatrous. I was with Dan Berrigan at a program some years back, and someone asked, Dan, how is it that you can go to the altar and offer your liturgy when you know a woman can't do that? He said, well, regrettably, each time I do that, I feel like I compromise myself. So I try not to do that. He said, I try for a concelebration, that there will always be women and men celebrating together. And I think for myself that it's a great anguish to know that women cannot be the priests. There are more and more restrictions on what women can do in a number of our churches. And it's very painful, and it's very dispiriting. But for me, it's a form of idolatry. If only a male can be pope, if only a male can be a cardinal, if only a male can be bishops or priests, that's idolatry in the 21st century. And I think we need to acknowledge that and say we need to break out of that because we believe in the primacy of the church being community. And the structures and the systems and the institutions are there to foster community. If they don't, they're obstacles to us. So we need to remove them. So those are the breakthroughs that I want to put forward. I'm watching my time, and I know it's late for all of you. Just a few concluding reflections. I'll give you a moment of quiet after that, and then I know there's some time for interaction, but we'll get to that in a moment. My own reflections on all of this is that the time in which we live is sacred. And I believe that many of us are tending more and more to our spirituality, to a depth of my spirituality, to my growth in spirituality, it's not synonymous with my religious affiliation. Therefore, I find, particularly among young people who I teach, but a growing number of older Catholic laity who have formed the faith-based communities and not connected to an institution, maybe not even connected to a parish, but developing new forms because the old forms are dispiriting. They're not giving me spirit and life. I'm not being inspired. So I need to inspire myself so my spirituality gets deeper. So I'm finding a distinction between deepening my spirituality from the traditional religious practices and institutions that we've been a part of. And I think that's a phenomenon of our day that we need to look at. I think also in terms of our sense of nationalism, we're experiencing tensions and may be facing new breakthroughs regarding the peace movement and efforts to the conversion of a military to the promote human and social services, to advance humans' quality of life. And I think that's very important because we're basically citizens of the United States, many of us born here, but we're also Catholic, so we're universal. We're also citizens of a planet. I have a responsibility to the millions and billions of people who are alive. Marie Augustiniel was a wonderful sociologist that we had many years ago, and she came to a conference and said, "I want to know how many people are in your community." And she gave us a few moments to think about it. And some said, "Oh, my husband and my two children." Some said, "Oh, my father and mother." We had all different responses. The community I live with, seven of us, she said, "Your community is comprised of 7 billion people." I never forgot it. So that when we have the prayer each day that says, the priest says, "The Lord be with you," I always say, "and with all people." I'm not there just to pray with the people I'm in the church with for that service. I'm with all people. So my community is 7 billion. And whenever I have the opportunity, I want to pray for those 7 billion people who form my human community. And that's a beautiful lesson that I learned that I think certainly gives us a whole approach to how we want to look at spirituality, to look at relationships, to look at community, and to look at gender equality. I just bring it to a conclusion by offering you a reflection from Mary and Elizabeth when they went for their visitation. That's a very beautiful scene, these two women who visited, and mysteries in their life. They really did not know all that was going on. Very mysterious, and they had to trust. And what they said is, "With God, all things are possible." And another way it said is, "Nothing is impossible with God." So in conversations when I would be asked, "Do you believe that women will be ordained?" "Nothing is impossible with God." And that's how we need to look at it. It's not a matter of whether this pope will do it, this pope hasn't done it. The reality is the women are already ordained. And they've been ordained actually since the end of the Second World War, during the time of communism in Eastern Europe. They ordained married men, they ordained women, and they continue to be ordained. And now we have the Roman Catholic women movement of women who've been ordained validly, but not licitly. So nothing is impossible with God. So let me give you a moment just of quiet, and then I would invite any questions or comments that you may have. Thank you. I'm going to ask Chris or someone on the committee if you will let us know how much time we have and when you want to bring it to a close. So is there a mic? Oh, thank you. If you'd like to just go to the mic, or If you can be heard from your seat, it may be helpful to stand. And I'm interested not only in a question, but your comments, your insights. Right? Is there anything that I've said that you say that relates to you, or you say, no, that's very, very different from you? It's very important that we're able to dialogue about that. So just stand up and speak out.
If you let us know, we'll come around with a microphone.
If you have a good, strong voice, we may hear you anyway, so. Right over here. Mm-hmm.
I was just very happy, first of all, that you're here, sister. But also, I was very happy to hear you talk about the Our Father. I tend to do that myself. I don't say it real loud, but I say Our Father, Mother, because I thought, I just can't see God being anything but both characteristics in the sense of love and strength and whatever, mm-hmm. because we're origins of God.
Right.
And I need to keep that image ever before me, and so I do it just to help myself and hope that others might pick up on it along the way. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. And I'd encourage you, if you find it awkward, maybe in your own personal prayer, if you're praying the rosary or some other prayer, and wanted to just begin with Our Father, Mother, see if you feel uncomfortable. You may for a while, then at times you may feel more comfortable. Or use another form of how we call God. I often say God, my creator. I mean, God, our creator, is a very powerful, powerful presence of God in our lives, too. Thank you, though.
Mm-hmm. I enjoyed what you said.
Oh, thank you.
Our group has kind of given up on the church. And we have gone the way of interfaith. We feel that many other faiths have much to say. We still feel that the Catholic Church, if they would take some leadership in gender equality, would make a big difference in the world. But we feel we can make more understanding, more connections, more community by learning more about the Jewish faith, more about Islam, and they maybe would learn a little about us. I think if you talk about the world, we've got to talk about the whole world.
Good. Thank you. I think it's very important, and you alerted me to it. We need to have confidence in our own inner spirit and in the promptings of our spirit. One of the things that I've learned through the years is to be very in touch with my intuitions. All right, that doesn't mean I'm just going to pop up any word that I would like at any time, but to be in touch with my intuitions and to say, what do I think the Spirit is calling me to do and to be? Now, when you are sitting in a group with other people and you say, I like to call God Mother as well as Father, you may get a great deal of hostility. So you need to just be aware of that. But I think it's very important. We are in a creative moment. So moving into another form of community with other people who share that Spirit is just a spiritual food for you, and you absolutely need that. And so I don't think that we should feel any guilt about it, and we should proclaim it. Proclaim it to anybody who will listen to us. I went to Future Church. I mean, I go to Call to Action regularly, and I'll come back and meet people who say, isn't that radical? And I often say, not radical enough for me. Really not. No. Because it's strong, committed Catholic laity who are very faithful to the church and who are searching and seeking. And I think it's of very few people who would have the sense of radicality that your Father Louis had that you've just spoken about, who would do what he did and then announce it, proclaim it to the whole diocese here, and the lasting effects that it has had. So I think I would just encourage us all not to be apologetic, but to proclaim it and say, I'm getting such life and hope and grace and spirit from this experience that I want to tell you about it. And some people will not be able to hear it. Some people, it's very strange behavior. But you just have to continue to do it. I'll tell you one quick story. I went to church on Ash Wednesday, and it was a parish church, and the church was filled. And I was going to go up for ashes, and I heard the priest say, "Remember, man, that thou art dust. Remember, man, that thou art dust." Now, I've gotten to a point where I can't just do that quietly, you see. So I said, well, I don't need to get ashes. I mean, what's the point? I don't have to tell everybody I got ashes. It's not even a holy day in the church. Would you believe that? Ash Wednesday and Good Friday are not holy days. But August 15th is a holy day. Something really wrong about that when everybody's at the beach. But so anyway, I was not going to get online. Finally, I said, no, I'm getting online. I walked up to the altar, and I said, what am I going to do? So I got up near him. I put my hand up. I said, Father, when you give me ashes, please don't say man. So he got flustered, but not upset. So he said, he didn't answer me. Remember that thou art dust. So I went back to my seat, and I could hear him say, remember that thou art dust. And then he started again, remember man. But I looked up, and a man came up, he said, remember man. Woman came up, he dropped the man. So after Mass was over, I went to the sacristy, and I said, I'm the woman who asked you not to say man. He said, I never thought of such a thing before. You're right. Most of those parishioners were women, and I was calling them all man. So I just use that story because, like, it was an anxiety for me, but at the same time, I said, I cannot not do it. Okay. There are certain things we need to do because it's good for our spirit to do. It just may not be the orthodox thing to do. Yes, I'm taking too much of the question and answer time here. Yes.
I just wanted to make two comments. One is just the whole idea that women made in the image of God should be whatever they are capable of being and desire to be or feel that God is leading them to be, because it's a matter of justice. And I think a church that proclaims justice and teaches people about justice needs to be just. And I think they need to maybe do some, the hierarchy needs to be looking at, you know, some self, some introspection and say, okay, where are we falling down in living with the very things we proclaim? The other thing I wanted to say, too, is I do think very much that by taking the position that the hierarchy takes in regard to women, that they're missing the opportunity to be in the vanguard in protecting all women around the world. So many women, even in our own country, are abused and treated with great disrespect, whether it's domestic violence or whether it's the commercials on TV, on the Super Bowl, whatever, the way women are treated as objects. And I think the church is really missing the opportunity to say women and men are equal and that's all there is to it.
Thank you very much. Yeah. I would want to just say that I've come to an insight, and I think it's accurate that as long as we have a totally male hierarchy and all of the synods and all of the councils are only present to men and men speaking and also speaking about women, it just seems to me that for that to go on systemically, it's saying to me that those men are incapable of being able to realize the insights that we have because they haven't walked in our shoes. So I don't think by nature they are, but I think by the way they've been conditioned, many of these men who are in the hierarchy are impotent. And I've said that in relation to gender equality. I've come to a belief that they're impotent because they don't even have a sense of it. It's like the ignorance and the arrogance. And I try to say to some of them, do you realize how this is affecting women? Well, you know, it's only affecting a few of you. I don't hear many of the women saying that. But I said, but if you were listening carefully and if you were having groups of women coming into your community's services and listening carefully, you would hear much more about it. But it's a very sad thing, and you're absolutely right. When I was at the UN conference on women in China, it was embarrassing for Catholic women, and there were about 150 sisters at that. There were 30,000 women at it, because they seemed to side, the Catholic representatives who were there from the Vatican, was siding with the more fundamental Islam group. And they really did not speak powerfully or in any way strongly to the whole issue of women in terms of abuse, in terms of trafficking of women, in terms of rape of women. None of that got mentioned by anybody from that Vatican delegation. And it was very embarrassing, and I thought it was a marvelous opportunity for the church to proclaim. But I think until we move to another level, they're, as an institution, incapable, because it's not in, you know, if it's not in your mindset, it's not in your gut, if you don't have a conviction about it, it's not there. But I think we have the conviction about it. One of the women told me that since she's the advent of email, if she used to previously, if there was something went on in church while she was there, she'd take out a notepad, she'd write a note, and she'd drop it in the collection basket instead of the money. But recently she said, I've taken to use email. I take the parish bulletin home, and then I have been thoughtfully able to write out what my critique was of what happened at that parish liturgy, which I thought was wonderful. I'm always saying I'm going to do it, and then I don't do it. But those are many, many techniques that we can do to